Every March, pandemonium descends upon Austin, Texas. It does so in the form of South by Southwest, a music, technology, and film festival that takes over the city for a few weeks. It's kind of fun, but as a local resident, kind of a mess too. Commutes stretch out interminably. Normally low-key restaurants have lines out the door, and the crowds are inescapable. So in the midst of South By, a few of us in UT's digital writing and research lab traded Austin for a city where pandemonium reigns every month of the year, Las Vegas, where we attended the 2013 Conference on College Composition and Communication, or 4Cs. It's an annual scholarly conference on rhetoric, composition, and writing pedagogy. And for those of you who didn't brave Las Vegas's infinite hallways and Mobius-inspired highway system, we're bringing you four interviews with 4C's attendees who are doing remarkable work at the intersections of rhetoric and technology. I chat with Kathleen Blake Yancey, a professor of English at Florida State and editor of the journal College Composition and Communication, as well as Ron Brooks, an Oklahoma State professor who talks with me about pedagogy and the TV show Top Chef Masters. And two Zugma guest contributors and current DWRL members talk with two DWRL alumni. Stephanie Odom interviews Wisconsin's Jim Brown, and Megan Gianfagna interviews Kentucky's Jenny Rice. Those interviews are coming up next. Bringing you what happened in Vegas, this is Eric Detweiler with the Zugma Podcast.
That was perfect.
I'm Kathleen Blake Yancey, and I teach at Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today. So I wanted to start off with your panel and presentation at CES this year.
Mm-hmm.
So you focused on everyday writing.
That's correct.
And I was wondering if you could explain for us a little bit what exactly constitutes this everyday writing and the way you're thinking about it, if there are particular genres or writing practices that you see as falling inside or outside of the everyday as you're conceiving of it.
Okay, that's a great question, and at the same time, it's a hard question. At our place, we have a number of people who are working on what we would call everyday writing. One of the distinctions we've been trying to draw is between everyday writing and vernacular writing. And we typically think in terms of Gerald Hauser's definition of vernacular, which points to the role that writing plays in resistance and social justice contexts. That overlaps with everyday writing, but everyday writing doesn't stipulate that the writing has to be pointed toward those ends. So everyday writing could almost pretty much be anything from a grocery list to postcards, letters, diaries. So the kinds of writing that people engage in every day. But I do think it's a great question you ask, because I think the definition is key to what is in and what is out, as it were. So let me give you two examples that we might think with, so that I can actually not give you an answer and help us think about defining this, yes, as a field. So one issue has to do with whether, you know, when we say writing, people tend to think of with words. I'm more interested in writing that would not be in words only, made not only words, one might say. So I'm interested in writing that's very visual. I'm very interested in posters, for example. I'm very interested in scrapbooks, which are very visual. I wouldn't always say primarily visual, it sort of depends. But that is absolutely within the realm of everyday writing for me, though I understand that it might not be for everybody else. I'll also say that people, when they think about everyday writing, are often interested in historical studies of writing. So, but I want to be clear that everyday writing could include a tweet, right? So it's not necessarily located in print. So that's one question. The second I thought was really interesting when I was thinking about Doug Hesse's talk. He was the first speaker on that panel, as you know. And in looking at the writing that he was sharing with us, he looked at an autopsy report, which I thought was very interesting, because that isn't everyday writing of the same variety, in the sense that the person whose death was being certificated, if you will, was not the composer of that. It also raises the issue of what role you think a form plays. Now, my own research has suggested that people actually, everyday writers, actually like forms and tend to use forms and then play off them in a way that's very interesting. So that's my way of saying that everyday writing is, first of all, can be very capacious. Second of all, is clearly in need of a definition. And third of all, I've tried to identify two areas where I think we would want to focus in providing such a definition.
Well, I think you brought up some really interesting examples in what you were saying there, like the autopsy report and other things like that. Maybe in your presentation, mm-hmm. you had focused on sort of four what you called micro histories.
That's correct.
Of everyday writers and writing communities. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, for our purposes here, if you could maybe give us like a micro look at one of those one of those four to help us get a concrete sense of what you're talking about.
Sure. So the scope was broad, and I mentioned four scenes. One was writing, documenting, narrating, responding to, and so forth. The 1906 San Francisco earthquake. The second was the writing composed by a young group of Japanese American women called the Crusaders inside Japanese American internment camps. The third was the writing that constituted the Boston Women's Health Collective, leading to the multi-edition volumes of Our Bodies, Ourselves. And then the fourth was something called the Quake Book, which was a just-in-time book produced and marketed by Amazon, the profits for which went to the Japan Red Cross in response to the March 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown at Fukushima in Japan. I would focus probably on the Crusaders, which mm-hmm. was a group of five young, late teenage aged young women, formed at the Santa Anita Reassembly Camp, a reassembly camp being a location where Japanese Americans were sent prior to their being sent to the internment camps. And it was at the Santa Anita Reassembly Camp that Mary Nakahara, who then would be called Yuri Kogayama, eventually her first given name was Yuri, she had taken a westernized name, Mary, then she married Bill Kogayama, so hence Yuri Kogayama. Mary was working in a Sunday school class while she was at Santa Anita, and she experienced, while being at Santa Anita, of course, a series of events and episodes that awakened her to discrimination in a way that had previously not been part of her experience. She was very frustrated. She writes about this in her diary. And she says at one key moment in the diary that if there's nothing else she can do, that she will, quote, write to persuade, as I've never written before. And that's a telling moment. That seems to be connected to the start of the Crusaders, whose goal was to write to Japanese American servicemen overseas. They started with two mm-hmm. Over an 18-month period. The list grew to 5,000. People in the internment camps contributed money to pay for postage. They were writing an onion skin paper through V-mail in order to save weight and thus save postage. The soldiers were so grateful to receive what were first postcards, because they were the cheapest form of correspondence, then letters, then the list was so long they went to newsletters, used a mimeograph machine, and the soldiers were so grateful for this correspondence that they sent back part of their salaries. What interests me about this was how smart these young women were. They saw a way to connect people who did not know each other as a community through writing, and it's just astonishing to me that someone could do this, but it really was a kind of 6 degrees of separation. One person went to the next. And also, the materials that are held in the Japanese American Museum, there's some others in the San Jose Japanese American Museum, include letters, cards, postcards, etc., that were sent back by the Japanese American soldiers. So there's much more to the story than I have time to relate now, but it's a pretty good example of how everyday writers can actually exercise much more agency than sometimes we believe that they can.
Hmm. Well, that's fascinating, and I was interested, you were talking about the different materials that they used, whether it was, you know, V-mail, sort of diaries, letters, onion skin paper, all this stuff. When we think about technology, I guess we might often just jump to sort of mental images of computers and, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. iPads mm-hmm. or whatever, but it seems like these are certainly technological means that shaped these practices in a lot of ways.
Right.
Are there any, you know, sort of, I don't know, either specific or sort of generalizable ways in which, as you've been doing this research, you've seen everyday writing, everyday writers interacting with technologies and maybe forms, as you mentioned earlier, in particular ways?
Sure. So, I mean, the short answer is yes. Then we could be done.
Yeah.
Again, just to think aloud a little bit. One thing that's interested me more recently, and this is actually a function of working with Stephen McElroy, who is a graduate student mm-hmm. at Our Place, who's doing a fascinating dissertation looking at how postcards that were produced by the Tyke Manufacturing Company were produced. Now, the reason that's relevant here is that he's looking at the full composing process. And when we think about the full composing process, at least in school contexts, we often think in terms of students writing lots of drafts on whatever technology that they're using, and that they're submitted or they're published, but we don't actually ordinarily usually engage them in fact in the production process of getting something published. And that's very interesting, because that's what the Crusaders engaged in. It was a full composing process. They had to understand that the onion skin was lighter, that the materiality actually made a difference. When they decided to go to newsletters, they had to figure out how they were going to make this work with a duplicating machine, and they had to develop a new model of labor so that they could get those newsletters posted. If you got 5,000, this is not a small group of worker bees, this is not a small consideration. That's really interesting to me, because we don't think about the full composing process in that sense. To go back to the San Francisco example, one of the reasons that the postcards are so interesting was because of the invention of a particular kind of brownie camera in 1903. The earthquake was in 1906. One of the interesting things that we might observe in terms of how everyday writing was used to document, narrate, record, etc., the 1906 earthquake and the 1900 hurricane that devastated Galveston, is that the Brownie camera was invented in between. You have many, many more images of the San Francisco disaster than you do of Galveston. Now, there are a couple of reasons for this. It's not all about the technology, but the camera actually has something to do with this. And there were people who created what's called in the field of postcard studies, if you will, real photo postcards, which are postcards created by everyday writers who basically took the picture, pasted it on some kind of card and sent it away. That's astonishing. The technology actually matters. So I'm not a determinist. I don't think that the technology determines what we're doing. I'm actually more interested in an approach that's outlined by Catherine Hales, which suggests that when you put one set of writing practices in dialogue with another, created at different moments in time, then you begin to understand both similarities and differences between the two of those, and what role technologies played in each of those.
We're getting close to time, but I wanted to just, in terms, sort of specifically thinking in technological terms.
Sure.
Besides the things you've talked about so far, are there any other sort of projects or interests you're pursuing at the moment? Or you could also, if there's things that you're noticing, since you serve as the editor of College Composition and Communication, that you think would be worth noting for people listening here?
Sees, we have a lot of interest in technology that is inside school. So if we look at the September 2012 issue on research methodologies, we could look at Chris Anson's and Bob Schwegler's piece on eye tracking technology. That was pretty interesting. We could look at Derek Mueller's piece on the long tail and on trying to see which scholars are making what kinds of contributions at one moment in time, but also the value of the long tail is that you have a much more comprehensive account. So there's no question that we look at technology inside the academy. We are looking at technology outside the academy as well. And I like that full view, that hence my interest in everyday writing, by the way. So I like the full view. I think there's no question about that.
Well, Dr. Yancey, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Eric. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah?
Next stop northbound is Flamingo Caesar's Palace Station.
This is the closest station to Bill's Gambling Hall and Saloon, Hilton Grand Vacations, and Westin Las Vegas Hotel.
The Las Vegas monorail is a handy way to get around and takes you past some curious aspects of the city. as the monorail's speakers play a tangled mix of music, Vegas trivia, and ads for the city's attractions, you pass, for instance, huge asphalt lots on the backside of a Las Vegas golf course. These lots are filled with trees awaiting planting. Not little scrubby saplings wrapped in burlap, mind you, full-grown 50-foot-tall trees sprouting out of soil-filled wooden boxes the size of dumpsters. How did they get here? Next stop, DWRL Assistant Director Megan John Fania talks with Jenny Rice, who's an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, Kentucky. They talk about Dr. Rice's 2012 book, Distant Publics, as well as writing pedagogy and the spatial construction of Austin and Las Vegas.
This monorail continues northbound. Next stop, Harrah's Quad Station.
Hi, this is Megan John Fania, guest contributor for the Zugma podcast. I'll be talking today with Jenny Rice, assistant professor of writing, rhetoric, and digital media at the University of Kentucky. We're here at Four Seasons Las Vegas, and we're going to take some inspiration from this strange and wonderful place to talk a bit about the rhetorical aspects of cities. Thank you for joining us, Jenny.
Thanks.
What interests you most about studying place? What got you started down this track?
I think it was really being in Austin, which was a place that I had lived in since I had left high school. So I, came to Austin in 1993 for the first time, and I really got experience watching it grow. When I moved to Austin, it seemed to have a very strong sense of identity. It was almost like a character, I watched it grow and change over those years, between 1993 and 2005 when I left. It was almost like a child growing up in some ways, that it had really grown in size, and it had matured even its economy. And so there were a lot of very different things happening. I think just from being in that atmosphere, it made me start reflecting on place a lot more. And then as I was in graduate school and was starting to read more theory about place, it helped give me a language and a vocabulary for understanding and contextualizing these changes that were happening. And as somebody who's interested in rhetoric as well, I was interested in the role that discourse was playing in all of these changes too. So it kind of all came together for me around the time that I was starting my dissertation.
Oh, yeah. Good. Okay. In Distant Publics, you investigate the rhetorical construction of Austin, Texas as a public space. What were some of the major tropes and patterns you mapped in that book?
Well, I was really interested in the arguments that people were having about places. So in the book, I looked at three major, I would call them sort of argumentation patterns that people would fall into, specifically about development and change. So I talked about the ways that people talk about old Austin versus new Austin. And, that's a very strong rhetorical pattern that happens in that place, as well as a lot of other places that are experiencing rapid change like Austin. So places where there's a lot of gentrification that happens on a citywide level or a large-scale level. And it's that kind of pattern is really interesting to me because it does certain kinds of work. It's not just about nostalgia, but it allows people to make certain arguments. They are really creating their own sense of who they are in relation to the city as well. So I was kind of interested in that. I was also interested in the ways that people argue about... I was interested in the ways that people kind of exclude themselves from having to sort of intervene in the problems that they also identify. Mm-hmm. Part of that is kind of a play in the term distant publics, because people often will distance themselves from a problem if they don't think that it relates to them. So I had a particular interest in East Austin, which, when I first moved there in 1993, I remember one of those apartment hunters. I don't know what you call them, but I was 18, so I went to an apartment hunter who kind of drives you around, and he got this map out, and he said, okay, well, you definitely don't want to live anywhere east of this. And he was pointing to I-35.
Yeah.
And, so for me, East Austin was like the edge of the world, and the things happening there somehow didn't relate to me. Now, when I went to graduate school, I actually lived in East Austin, And it was gentrifying at that time. And right now it's really gentrified, just, you know, visiting it very recently. It's a very different kind of place. And so I'm interested in the ways that people either take up problems or don't take up problems as a result of how they see themselves related to it. So those are some of the things that I looked at in the book.
Based on your short time in Vegas for C's, do you have any initial impressions about how public space is constructed here, with similarities or contrasts with Austin's potential points of discussion?
Vegas is one of those places that clearly the ways that spaces are set up and designed, and the, you know, the laws, that in the kinds of freedoms that people have to do things in the streets that normally they're not allowed to do. Like, well, for example, this morning, you know, I shared a bus stop at 7 in the morning with a guy who had a beer, and, you know, you're not, normally that's not something you would see, and here it's not any kind of issue. People are walking everywhere, they're encountering each other. And there was a few years ago when I was thinking a lot about the differences between private space and public space, and I think as time goes on more and more, that distinction becomes less clear for me. It becomes a bit more confused, because you could sort of see that every space is shot through with a sense of publicness. And, you know, and here too, publicness in the streets, there's all kinds of people intermingling. So there's people, there's conference goers, there's people on vacation, there's people who live on the streets, there's vendors here. So you could say in some sense it's a very interesting kind of public space, and yet it's clearly overcoated with a lot of private corporate interests that's monitoring all of that. You know, there's this ad campaign about Vegas, so what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And what's interesting is that since I've been here, I've heard that reference in, you know, just passing conversation by at least a couple people, right?
Yes.
So even that kind of commercialized, it affects how we talk to each other, and perhaps even how we think we're supposed to encounter this place, but it's an ad campaign that was thought up. That's more interesting to me, is the discourses that are in place and kind of shape how we interact with those places. The other thing about Vegas is that for many of us, anytime we've come, I think this is my third time or fourth time in Vegas, but I've only ever stayed around here. So you tend to think of this as Vegas and forget that, you know, many people live here and that there is a life going on beyond this very extensive playground, really.
Yeah.
And I don't think that would hold up as a public-private distinction. So I think there are other terms that we can use. And for me, public discourse is always in everything. It's attached to everything, even in the most secluded and isolating of spaces.
Mm-hmm. Great. So you write a lot in the book about practicing rhetoric with the goal of inquiry. Mm-hmm. And so when I was reading it, it was about surveying the scene, it was about archiving, it was about embracing complexity, all in part to unlearn, as you say in the book, particularly stickier universal ideas about place. So you've translated this practice into the writing classroom in multiple ways that you share with us in the book. And I was wondering, when you ask your students to do this kind of work where the focus isn't about mastering content or producing a sort of polished, complete, you know, in quotes, argument, how do you manage, help them manage that discomfort that might arise from this kind of more open-ended assignment, where part of the goal is sort of to let these meanings sit and resonate and not resolve?
There's definitely a frustration that happens, and I can sense it. I just got done teaching in the fall a first-year writing course that was centered on work in the archives about kind of historical segregation in Lexington. But we also had a visit from Eddie Daniels, who was a South African anti-apartheid activist who was in prison with Nelson Mandela for 19 years.
Oh, wow.
So we also learned at the same time about apartheid and segregation in South Africa, and we got a chance to talk with him and interview him and hear his story. And asking students to work in the archives and having them do this kind of exploratory stuff can be very frustrating for them. So you do have to sort of manage frustration. And part of it is not trying to banish frustration, but in fact trying to get people to learn how to use frustration as a point of kairos or creativity. You know, it's a point of invention. It can open up. And it's not as if we as writers and academics don't experience frustration, because I do all the time,
yes,
you know. And sometimes that frustration can be sort of a blockage, or it can be used. There's a problem there. You know, frustration is like a big tangled knot, and there's something there. The trick is to be curious about the frustration. So what is it that's frustrating me here? There's a question that needs to be looked at, or there's something here that can be interesting. Trying to do that with students, trying to do that with myself is very hard.
Yeah.
Trying to do that with people who, you know, are in their very first year of college is also very challenging. And as a teacher, for me, I have to learn how to let that frustration be in the classroom and not be afraid of it. Because, you know, as a teacher, you don't want students to be frustrated, but you also don't want them to feel discouraged. So I do a lot of talking with them about why we're doing this, and try to be very open and explanatory about the logic behind this assignment, why I'm asking them to do this. And it may not work for them at this exact moment. And this is something that I've had to learn and relearn a lot, and trust that at some point, this may be helpful for them.
Yeah.
If it's not in this 15 weeks, and it may be, you know, a little bit, but to make sure that, you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, 6 years from now, that there's something there that we kind of unlearned and tried to relearn. And it's not always content driven. For me, the course would be successful if students learn that they need to be curious. And curiosity is something that kids have when they're very young, and we kind of lose for some reason after a certain point. And so you kind of have to relearn it. And I'm very open with students about that. The one thing that we're learning is learning how to be curious.
Interesting. I just wanted to loop back around for our final question to your time in Austin as a graduate student when you were working in what was then the computer writing and research lab,
yeah,
and is now the digital writing and research lab. And we were just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experiences there and how they have experienced your professional life and or your work.
I would say my time in the CWRL, it's hard for me to make the switch to the D, was probably the most transformative thing that happened to me. And there's not a lot of places like what's happening there. So some of the things that were really helpful to me, in addition to just having the space to do these things, is that we were not only allowed, but we were encouraged and almost required to be experimental.
Yeah.
And pushed to do different things. Nobody ever said, you can't do that. In fact, it was exactly the opposite, where it's like, go out, find something new, and experiment with it, and then report back. And that kind of environment is rare. I mean, I look back on that time and just think, wow, I was really lucky to be there with that. The ethos that is still there, I mean, I can see it just from a distance, is be bold and be experimental. And that the graduate students really are the ones leading the way. It is one of the key things for me, I think, that made me today who I am.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much.
A challenge. See how long you can walk indoors in Vegas without ever covering the same territory twice. My guess is that it could take days. Casino winds into casino, into a food court, into a shopping mall. And if you're there at the same time as the Pac-12 college basketball tournament, your walk is strangely punctuated by the UCLA pep band.
The craps?
Yeah.
I'm Ron Brooks, associate professor at Oklahoma State University. I direct the composition program there, and I'm interested in theories of posthumanism, post-process theory, and this emerging category called post-composition. I'm on Twitter at RooksBay, R-O-O-K-S-B-A-Y, which is Brooks in Pig Latin.
I like that approach.
Well, you mentioned as you were talking there that sort of post-composition has been one of the things you're working on. So your panel at Four Seas this year takes Sidney Dobrin's book, Post-Composition, as its starting point. So could you talk a bit about the key arguments and concerns of that book to help us get some context for your response to it?
Sure. Just to summarize, and this may be oversimplifying the case, but I think what's most interesting about post-composition is that Sid Dobrin's written a very challenging and interesting book that's trying to get us as people who are interested in composition to think beyond what he calls the pedagogical imperative. And that is people who are, I guess he might even say, suffering under the pedagogical imperative are only thinking about writing as it relates to the teaching of writing in university or other educational settings. And I think that what he's really concerned about regarding that is that it really limits the way that we get to think and the way that we get to theorize about writing. So his attempt is really to sort of shake composition teachers out of a certain comfort, and it certainly has done that for me, and get us to think beyond that limited frame.
So in that case, so how did you go about in your presentation sort of engaging with that book and his arguments?
In that presentation, I really just tried to focus on the relationship between linguistics and composition and writing in general. And I looked back at a historical moment in the 1950s when some people were arguing, they were debating about whether or not we should focus on standardized grammar in the composition classroom. Some people were saying, yes, we most definitely should. If we don't show students standards, we won't have anything to teach, or you know, they need to learn these things. And other folks were trying to take a much more complex view of the picture, and try more to describe the way people talk and the way that people write, in a way that reflects, I guess, the full complexity of the way we interact with one another. And so I picked up that moment, and I think it's, you know, that's really just sort of a tiny piece of a much larger puzzle, and I tried to make that clear during the presentation. You know, some of the other panelists talked about thinking about computer code as a moment of post-composition and looking at that, another panelist talked about the way that writing as therapy might, and as a therapeutic model, might be really useful, not to make classrooms about therapeutic writing, but to really more thoroughly look at how writing itself is therapeutic, and work with that. So, and then Sid responded. I think that Sid and I sort of went back and forth a little bit, because I'm a writing program administrator, and I direct a composition program. So the book really made me uncomfortable in a lot of ways. But I liked that challenge. I liked being challenged by that. And I think he appreciated me expressing my frustration at the same time that I really took in his books and his ideas.
Well, this is sort of another thing that intersects with your work with writing and composition, and much of that work concerns sort of the post-process movement. And I was wondering if you could take a quick minute to sort of explain that term for us a little bit, perhaps focusing on sort of that post in post-process in particular, whether it's, you know, signifying against process or beyond or just after, or what exactly is happening there.
I think lots of people define it in very different ways, and I'm very comfortable with the idea of post-process theory if we look at it as the process movement is something that happened. We tried to acknowledge more readily that writing is a process, and at one point in our history, and there's a lot more than you can teach in a classroom than that. So we're in a post-process period that both contains the process movement, but also helps us move beyond thinking just as of writing as a process, especially in a very formulaic way. We don't want to have students just sort of memorize the stages of the writing process and regurgitate that back to us. My stance on the issue is that, on one hand, I really want to hold on to some of the key moments of the process movement. And one of the things that I like to argue is that the process movement hasn't really even taken place yet. That if we kind of go back and look at what folks were really saying, and not the way that their work got reduced, I think that some of the critiques that we've come to in the post-process movement have already been made. So I'm still wanting us to hold on to some of the original impulses. The original process movement, you know, if you really look at, and Cirque makes this argument as well, you know, looking back at, I believe it was Diemer's essay, Composition as a Happening, you know, some of those original moments where we really tried to create something interesting and engaging in the classroom and then have students write from those moments of rupture or excitement, writing about what they're most passionate about, what's going on in their culture, speaking to their needs. I think that was a moment when the process movement was interesting. I think that as time went on, things became made a little too rigid, especially when we really tried to codify what was happening and make that apply universally to all students. Really, when we tried to administrate the process movement, it became something, I guess, that was worth reacting against. But my concern, I guess, with reacting against the process movement too quickly or too easily is that we might lose some of that original impulse that's engaged there, or that we make it about topics that aren't necessarily bringing about better writing from students. And I discovered this at the panel today. I wind up talking out of both sides of my mouth in a way, because I want to hold on to what was generative in the original impulses, but I also want to discard non-generative aspects, the parts that are codified or rigid or unproductive. But I don't want to lose students out of the equation altogether. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Well, that's maybe a point to jump into our next question. And this concerns an article that you had written that came out in 3Cs in 2009. And in that article, you talked a little bit about interrogating the notion of mastery in writing instruction, whether it's our own perceived mastery as teachers or our attempts to teach students to sort of master the writing process. So that touches back on some of the things you were saying there. So within the framework of post-process theory, how do you attempt that sort of interrogation of that idea of mastery in your work?
It's a tough question, because there's at least one part of me that has discovered through my experience that students become more confident in their writing when they learn certain notions about the craft. One of the things that I've been more and more surprised in my teaching is that a craft approach to writing can really bring about a lot of interest. Students, especially like if we're just talking about composition, which the C's article was talking about composition classes, students become really, really interested in craft issues when they're able to kind of choose their own topics and connect to things that are already interested to them. It's like, okay, so I already know this and I can put all of this down, but I really want to learn to present it in a way that's useful or interesting or exciting for me. And I think that's a spot when craft comes in. And I think at least from a purely academic standpoint, craft serves as a means of helping students to master their writing. I think the downside of that particular approach or that particular stance is that you have to surrender the idea of giving students content. And that can have some ethical ramifications that, you know, I know that sometimes teachers and myself included want to take students to a certain issue or a certain point of view in their class, sort of generate some teacher-driven content in the class because some issues are extremely important. And, you know, if I'm talking with some of my colleagues about this, you know, it's like, my student might be really passionate about her SUV. Is that a topic I'm going to allow her to write so that she can be passionate about it and learn to craft the perfect why I should get to write, you know, drive my SUV essay? It's worth thinking about, I think. But I ultimately, you know, if you put my feet to the fire, I would finally land in the craft category and allowing students to generate their own topics.
Yeah, and so another good way to talk about this, I think, is in the essay you had in a recent issue of Pretext on food theory. And in that essay, you talk about sort of the issues of authority and mastery as they sort of come up and are sort of embodied and practiced in the show Top Chef Masters.
Right.
So early on in that essay, you're talking a little bit about the various challenges that the chefs on that show have to undergo.
and you sort of start with this challenge that's sort of modeled on the stuff they have to do, and you say, the rhetoric of food, you have 30 minutes. So we may not have 30 to address just that question, but I want to sort of turn that challenge on you here if I can, especially for listeners who might not have a firm grasp on sort of the specific metaphors and questions and issues at work in that sort of rhetoric of food arena. So in short, here we go. The rhetoric of food, you have 2 minutes. Go.
Well, that's precisely, that challenge that you just posed to me is precisely, I think, one of the reasons I was really interested in that show, because I make some connections between that show and the way that we teach writing. Timed writing situations are terrifying for me, they're terrifying for students, and I think ultimately, probably from that challenge, I would wind up failing in the same way that Anita Lowe fails, because I don't do well under timed writing circumstances. But at the same time, those timed writing circumstances bring out in us things that we don't always know we have. But in terms of going on Top Chef as a writer, if there really were a show called Top Rhetor, I'd probably be one of the first people out the door, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that part of what that show made me think about is teaching as well, and writing, and how those things play out for all of us, and in a way it certainly plays out for students, but also for all of us in writing situations.
Well, and yes, so I guess you mentioned this coming up in sort of other arenas, and you've talked a little bit about the parallels between the cooking and the challenges on Top Chef and sort of the challenges students face in the writing classroom. Near the end of that article, you sort of pose a sort of specific connection. You put the question forward, how are we arranged? And you talk about that both in terms of how Top Chef contestants are arranged with the sort of teams and sort of sous chefs that they work with, as well as students and teachers in terms of how they're arranged in the classroom. So could you elaborate on that question and those parallels maybe a little bit? I mean, does it have to do with sort of collaboration or sort of power dynamics, or what do you have in mind there?
Well, that's a really intriguing question. I've noticed in my experience, and I'm one that tends, maybe on my own strengths, I tend to try to draw out collaboration amongst my students. I tend to also try to connect to the craft of writing in one way, really going way into the rhetorical tradition and having students, as appropriate to their situations, learn how they can strengthen their own work. So in that sense, I find myself as someone who engages the discourse of the analyst a lot. But I've also noticed in my role as an administrator that there are teachers that we would just call engaging the discourse of the master, who really are able, and this is a little bit of a composition heresy, but they are able to improve their students' writing through lecturing, through very direct, very directive kinds of moves. And I'm always, and I think that's part of what I was feeling my way through in that article, even though I'm not sure I even knew it at the time. I tend to write out of a certain amount of ignorance of what I'm actually wanting to get at until I get to my conclusions. But so I'm not even sure I really understood this point until I finally got that article finished. But it does seem to me that we respond to the way that the material conditions of the classroom are arranged, the way that we, the individual students that we have in front of us, we respond to those with different discourses. And I have had students that want, because they want more direction from me, they're putting me in the position of master in that sense, and I'm willing to step into that role and then back out of it again, because, I mean, the way that Lacan talks about love, and I always like this about the way he talks about love. He says, love is the sign that we are changing discourses. And I think that really applies to the teaching moment. You know, when you're working with that, you can't, I guess, to go back to post-process, right? You can't say that there's only one way to do this. You have to work with the material conditions you have in front of you, the needs and the desires of the students that you have in the room with you at the time, the amount of knowledge that they have about craft and experience, and work with that to sort of be present with that. And Lacan's been very useful for me, and especially his four discourses, the four discourse structures, to sort of know how to respond to those situations. For some people, that's just sort of a natural gift. For a teacher like me, it was very helpful for me to sort of think through those categories and learn how to make those shifts when appropriate.
We'll end on sort of a more straightforward literal food question here. So
okay.
I thought I
yes.
needed to put this to you because at least one of the Top Chef Masters contestants that is featured in the episode you discuss has a restaurant in Las Vegas called Fleur de Lis.
That's right.
And so I figured since we're here in Vegas, are there any particular places or kinds of food that you're especially looking forward to trying while you're here?
Not this trip, but I have eaten at Hubert Keller's restaurant, and it was an amazing experience. I know it's sort of a bit of a tourist trap, probably a little overpriced, but I would, if I didn't have two kids at home who also need food on the table, I would go back there. My wife and I ate there last time I was in Vegas. We ate there. It cost us, it was probably the most expensive meal I've ever bought. It probably the best meal I've ever had, but yeah, can't do it this time.
All right. Well, Ron Brooks, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You bet, Eric. It was nice talking with you.
Having only seen pictures of the Hoover Dam, I initially expected it to possess sounds of the same magnitude as its sites. The hum of electricity, huge rumbling motors, the sound of water crashing story after story. A friend and fellow conference attendee who grew up in Vegas clued me in, however, that the intake towers probably wouldn't be running. So the dam sounded more like chattering birds, conversing tourists, and mild gusts of wind. For now, back inside the city limits, where DWRL member Stephanie Odom sat down to talk with the University of Wisconsin's Jim Brown.
So I'm here in a hallway outside of Four Seas Panels with my friend Jim Brown, who's an alum of the Digital Writing Research Lab. And I want to talk to Jim today about some of the work that he's been doing. So I have some questions for you, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
In your teaching, you're currently having your students complete. Here's my real first question.
Okay.
How do you pronounce progymnasmata? Pro,
I say progymnasmata, but I don't know if that's actually. I think that's the way I've heard it. Yes, okay. Progymnasmata.
Progymnasmata. You just want the version with your name in it.
Yes, pro-gym. That's right.
Okay.
Pro gym exercises.
Okay. So you're currently having your students complete these exercises and then remix and rework those exercises in digital form.
Mm-hmm.
So for listeners who might be unfamiliar, could you give us a quick description and explanation of the progymnasmata in their classical form?
Sure, yeah. We're using Debbie Haughey's and Sharon Crowley's book, Ancient Rhetorics for Contemporary Students. And that book has, at the end of each chapter, these exercises that are sort of have been used classically for rhetorical training. So writing fables, writing tales, writing commonplaces, encomia, invective, all these exercises just to kind of, for invention, just to generate arguments, to do imitation exercises. We do some of that as well. So the kind of tradition there, the rhetorical tradition uses these as kind of practice for the game, right? So if I'm trying to learn how to invent arguments or learn how to inhabit language differently or learn how to kind of take on different voices in my writing or my speech, these exercises are designed to do that. So at the beginning of the semester, we started doing these exercises with that in mind. And I'm dealing with students who have probably never taken a course in rhetoric aside from possibly first year writing. They've really not encountered rhetorical theory before. The course is called Digital Rhetorics. Both of those terms are foreign to them, digital and rhetorics. And so we start here to get them thinking about rhetoric and thinking about rhetorical practice. And then the remixing is an attempt to say, okay, these exercises were designed for basically for speech and writing. What did they look like in other media? Sound, video, if you wanted to make one of them into a comic, if you wanted to make one of them into a graphic essay, what would it look like? What would have to change about the exercise? What new things do we learn about language, argument, or maybe even not language, just about rhetoric in general? What do we learn when we kind of remediate them? And that's all with an eye toward a bigger project, which is a remix project of a book that we're reading called Radioactive by Lauren Redness. So we're reading this book. It's a graphic novel about Marie Curie and about the discovery of radioactivity. It's not really a graphic novel in the sense that we normally think of it. It's more like almost like an art book. So there's text there, there's story there, there's history, primary documents, and then there's her sort of artwork alongside it. So So reading that, and then the idea is to digitally remix Radioactive in some way. So the progymnasmata exercises were just to say, remix at the kind of rhetorical level, at the level of, you know, the things we've always done in the field, and then to tinker with the technology. So some of the progymnasmata exercises look really strange and don't make explicit arguments. They're just kind of figuring out what they can do with a medium, which I was fine with because I wanted them to just play, mm-hmm. with the idea that eventually they're going to have to make arguments when they do this remix. I taught the class in a slightly different way. The last time I taught this class, we did the project, the kind of remix project was everyone did the same medium, which was a comic, and they did a comic version of the Crowley and Hawhey textbook. Uh-huh. So they each took a chapter in groups and did a comic version of the chapter. So, and that was interesting because we really got to know the medium of comics pretty well. We read comics, we read some graphic novels, and sort of tried to understand how comics make meaning differently than other kinds of texts. So we used Comic Life software for that, which is what made it digital. But after we did it, I realized it wasn't quite sort of digital enough for mm-hmm. me, insofar as we used a single medium that's not sort of necessarily digital. And it didn't give them the opportunity to kind of like think critically about what medium they wanted to choose to do a particular kind of thing. I chose the medium for them, and then they had to operate within it. And I think what got me thinking away from that model and toward this more open model where everybody gets to pick their medium, but what got me thinking in that direction is actually Jody Shipka's book, Toward a Composition Made Whole, which is about multimodal composition and pedagogy, multimodal composition in general, and about how multimodal doesn't equal digital, which I very much like. And then the other argument she makes is that what we can do, or what we should be doing, is allowing students to pick the representational system that allows them to do the thing they want to do. So they start from what they want to accomplish, and then they say, what does that look like? Is it dance? Her students do dance. Not just, I know how to dance, and so I'm going to do a sort of performative dance, but that like the dance allows me to do things that a paper or a video or whatever else wouldn't, mm-hmm. right? So our constraint is that it's a course on digital rhetorics, so it has to be digital in some way. They have to use digital tools in some way. But which digital tools they use is totally up to them. And they don't have to use the ones we cover in class even. I'm just exposing them to stuff. So if they want to go, some students already know certain other tools that they want to use. One student is tinkering with the idea of building something in Minecraft for his remix of Radioactive.
Is that a video game?
It's a video game where you can build things, you can make things. I wanted that to be possible, that mm-hmm. someone would say, well, I actually think that this medium allows me to do the thing that I want to do.
So if you want to fend off potential trolls here mm-hmm. who see digital instruction as taking time away from traditional, mm-hmm. quote, real or mm-hmm. substantial writing, mm-hmm. who have been listening to you talk about, like, you know, dancing or composing a mm-hmm. video game or a stop motion animation in a rhetoric class, mm-hmm. like how you bring
yeah,
it
how
your
would
fold.
I, yeah, I mean, so my first, I guess I have a few responses. The first would be that I would recommend Jody Shipka's book, which I've done to everyone who will listen for the last year or so, uh-huh. which is to say that, you know, rhetoric and writing are about, you know, expression, argument, the available means of persuasion. Those are not controversial claims. And to claim that this one medium that happens to be the one that has been dominant for the recent past, it's an arbitrary choice to choose a medium because it's just there and because it's the one that's been handed to us, right? It allows us to do certain things really well. I print out PDFs to read articles because that's the best technology for me. I can scribble on things, I can underline things, and I can do things that I can't do when I read it on a Kindle. But that's a choice I make, not the correct way to do it, right? So in terms of writing, I want students to see that as well, that the choice of medium is a rhetorical choice. It's enabling and constraining certain kinds of expression. That said, all of these things are always coupled with some sort of traditional writing component, a way to kind of allow them to reflect on what they've been doing. The field is, like, in terms of pedagogy, the field has moved.
Right.
And this is not so much a concern anymore. I feel like even as little as 10 years ago, it was a much bigger concern.
The research, the scholarship.
That's the piece that hasn't moved, right? So, you know, we'll see if that actually moves in the way that the sort of teaching and sort of classroom practices have shifted slightly.
Speaking of, you're working on something now called Hospitable Code.
It's actually changed. The title's new.
Oh, what is the new title?
Yeah, so the new title is Ethical Programs.
Okay.
The subtitle is Hospitality and the Rhetorics of Software. So what I'm working on, what I'm finishing now, writing the conclusion almost as we speak on the airplane here working on it, is an exploration of various software platforms to understand what kind of ethical determinations they make. So the book basically argues that the primary ethical predicament that we're dealing with right now is hospitality in networked life. That means that others, human and non-human, textual or otherwise, are sort of arriving at us constantly, whether we've invited them or not, on our desktops, sometimes in our homes, that sort of texts and bodies and objects move kind of more freely, not freely, but more freely. And so what that means is, how do we deal with this predicament of hospitality? We have the law of hospitality, which is big L law, and I'm taking all of this from Derrida, the law of hospitality that others will arrive, and then the laws of hospitality, small l, that we write in response to that law. How do we deal with this predicament? Well, we write laws which are immediately an attempt to exclude and kind of sift and filter and sort. Well, software does this. Software is sort of one of the ways in which, in these spaces, people, texts, are filtered and sifted and sorted. Who gets to talk, who gets to write, who gets to code, who gets to argue, who's participating, who's not. Those are all kind of ethical programs, is the term that I'm using, mm-hmm. in two senses of the word. One, they're software programs, computational artifacts that people write that then go out and do things in the world and make these determinations. But also, they enact ethical programs in the sense that we've always thought of ethics as a set of programs, that is, a set of rules that by which we live or hope to live. So the book argues that software, or argues that sort of all network software has to engage this problem of hospitality. Anything from like firewalls to Twitter has to deal with the arrival of others, whether they're wanted or not. And then tracing out how those ethical determinations shape what we can and can't do in these digital spaces. So,
yeah, and I'm sure you think about it in terms of people wanting to let Twitter into their lives. Like, mm-hmm. I was a pretty late adopter of Twitter. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see basically like what kind of tool or what kind of guest it might be mm-hmm. in my life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's arriving, of course, on phones and desktops all the time. One way to think about Twitter's ethical program, or one of its ethical programs, is to think about just the infrastructure of how relationships work in Twitter, as opposed to a place like Facebook. Mm-hmm. So in Facebook, it's a symmetrical network relation, meaning you friend someone, they friend you back, now you're connected. In Twitter, it's asymmetrical. You can follow someone unless they're blocking their tweets, which seemingly very few people do. You could follow, but that person doesn't have to follow you back for you to sort of figure out, or to follow them and see what they're writing. That kind of is it. That's the software sort of determining relations in a particular kind of way. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of ethical program that I have in mind. But then those sort of ethical programs trickle up or down, depending on your metaphor, to sort of human decisions as well. So you're deciding, you know, who to follow and who not to follow. You're deciding with what hashtag to use, or all these sort of determinations that are sifting and sorting and trying to figure out how to deal with this sort of influx of information, or how you want to distribute information. Mm-hmm. All of that is bound up for me with ethics, with how, like, again, how or whether we relate to one another.
I like the way you think, Jim Brown.
Thank you.
Just one more question here. For an upcoming project, so this is beyond the book project, mm-hmm. I guess, you're mashing up rhetorical theories in order to reconceptualize and explore their affordances for digital rhetorics. Could you give us an example of any particular theories you have or are planning on mashing, and what digital possibilities you see emerging there?
Yeah, so I don't know if I can give examples, because this is brand new.
Okay.
But the question I have, and it's an open one, is digital rhetoric just rhetoric in digital spaces, or is it a new set of theories that we need to operate in these digital spaces? And I don't have an answer for that question. So part of what I'm trying to get at in this new project would be to experiment with, okay, well, let's see if we could try to build new concepts, what could we do with them? None of it's really written. I have like drafted some things and sort of put together the chapter that I kind of put a very short draft together of a few months ago puts together like Longinus and Wayne Booth. that's the kind of thing I have in mind, is what do we do when we put these two together? It's constrained writing in the kind of, in the sense that I'm not allowing myself anything out of, outside of these two texts, which are arbitrarily chosen, to see what happens. Like I said, I don't know where that's going to go.
So did you kind of wave your hand over the rhetorical tradition and land on London?
Kind of, sort of, yeah. I tried to not be, like, I tried to just pick from the early section and the late section. Mm-hmm. So it's more just, the idea is just to get two things that are pretty, like, that are really separated historically. Not that that they have to be from a certain time period, right, but that they're separated, meaning that they've attended to different rhetorical situations, different moments in history that called for different kinds of things, and just to see when we kind of overlay them, what happens. And it's just an experiment that might not work. Luckily, I mean, my hope is that as a second project, I'm freed up to experiment a little bit.
Yeah, so. Well, it sounds like play is a thread that runs through what you ask your students to do,
yeah,
and what you...
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Just see what comes out of it. Yeah, so it's a question. I think what I like most about this new project is that it starts from a question that I have that I don't have an answer to, which is sort of probably the most interesting way to approach research, which we sometimes tend to forget, that we have to have the argument in mind already.
Right.
And so it's in this one, it's very explicit that when I'm proposing this project and talking to people about it, I say, I don't know if anything's going to come of this, but I'm going to try it and see what happens.
So thank you for sitting down with us today and sharing your trajectory of how you went from being a lab member and leader to a hotshot faculty member at
Wisconsin. Well, thank you.
Now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it for this week's episode from 4Cs. It's goodbye, Vegas, and back to Austin for us. Special thanks to Drs. Ron Brooks, Jim Brown, Jenny Rice, and Kathleen Blake Yancey, as well as guest interviewers Megan Gianfagna and Stephanie Odom. Zugma will be back in a couple of weeks with our next episode, which will focus on memory, memes, and myth-making on the internet. In the meantime, you can visit our website, zugma.dwrl.utexas.edu, to check out past episodes and an extra piece of our interview with Jim Brown, in which he discusses an example of one of his students' progymnosmata exercises. You can also look us up on Twitter and Facebook, or subscribe to the podcast via Liberated Syndication and iTunes. Monorail. Monorail.